Lisboa,
Bruxelles,
Berlin,
Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast, your friendly, slightly nerdy guide to everything going on across Europe. My name is Dominic Kramer. I'm speaking to you from Amsterdam, and I've got Katie Lee down the line in Paris. Hi, Katie.
And it's my turn to be late this week. How stressful. Yeah. What's going on?
It's contagious. I don't know what's going on, but I'm very glad you're here with your heavy breathing.
Do you want to tell listeners about that?
Yeah, so there's this weird thing with the new way we're recording. And some reason it's picking up Katie's breathing a lot. And our producers keep having to mute her because all the time you hear in the background.
It's because I'm recording in an airless cupboard. There isn't enough oxygen in here. I need the air to go to my brain or I can't carry on talking.
Sure.
But listeners, I hope you'll be spared of it again by our lovely producers. Thank you, producers.
Yes. Thank you, Morgan and Wojciech.
I actually wanted to start this week's episode by recruiting our listeners for a bit of mass investigation.
Ooh, go on.
We got a lovely email from a listener called Stephanie in Germany, and she has been repeatedly driven mad by something that she's witnessed at large supermarket chains in her corner of Bavaria, which is really sad-looking plants, which are only sad and dry and droopy because the supermarket doesn't have the ability to water them. Like, they were fine when they arrived, but they've wilted while sitting there on the supermarket shelf. And it seems really crazy that there's no tap at the supermarket where the staff could, like, fill up a watering can and keep these plants in a decent, sellable condition. But Stephanie has asked the staff and has been told that this is indeed the case. The supermarket staff don't have the ability to water the plants, which means that they often end up throwing away loads of perfectly good plants that should have just been watered.
It sounds like a major European crisis. I'm so glad you're bringing it up.
Well, this is the question. I mean, Stephanie is curious about whether this is a local problem or one that happens everywhere. Because if it is Europe-wide, she wants to start a petition about it. So I was thinking, if you too have noticed very sad, wilty plants at the local branch of your massive chain supermarket, can you please take a picture and send it to us along with your location? hello@europeanspodcast.com.
I think it's not the case in the Netherlands.
Oh, yeah?
Our plants always look completely happy and hydrated. I think sometimes overhydrated. I've heard that, like, those herb plants that you get at supermarkets, that they're, like, pumped with, like, too much water, and that's why they always die when they arrive in your home.
Oh.
I mean, at least in my house, they always die. The basil plant never lasts more than a week or so.
Are they doing it on purpose to make the basil look all juicy and fresh?
Yeah.
Well,
that's what I heard. I don't know if it's true. Someone please fact check me.
Okay, let's do one plant controversy at a time.
Okay,
we will
sorry.
Start by investigating the potential mass killing of plants across Europe by supermarket chains, and then we'll do the over-juicy wateriness of basil plants, okay?
Thank you. Deal.
Glad that we have an agenda. Let's talk about this week, though. What are we talking about on this week's podcast?
Yes, this week we're going to be talking a bit more about European defence. I realise we've talked about it a few times lately, but honestly, I feel like I still want to understand it all better. And also, there was some big news this week. The EU published this Readiness 2030 security strategy. The title refers to the date by which it is thought that Russia could have the capabilities to attack the EU. Mm. Rather terrifyingly, we've got someone extremely clever to come and talk to us about this strategy and about all the money that's being thrown at EU defence right now, and also about how different EU countries are contributing differently to Europe's ability to defend itself. Professor Marina Henke is the director of the Centre for International Security at the Hertie School. She'll be joining us later on in the show. But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week. Who has had a good week, Katie?
I am going to give a tentative good week to Radio Free Europe. You might have heard Dominic mention this briefly on the show last week. The news that the US was cutting off funding for this really historic and very crucial radio station broadcasting out of Prague. It's just one of the many good and important things around the world that the Trump administration is cutting funding to because they see it as, quote unquote, wasteful. But as audio people and as Europeans, this is really close to our hearts. And those hearts sank when we read the news nearly 2 weeks ago now that the US government was just cutting off its contract with Radio Free Europe with no warning, leaving them with about a month's worth of money in the bank to pay their journalists and keep the lights on. But there is a glimmer of good news. The Czech government have basically said that they're going to save this radio station.
What do you mean by basically said?
Well, I mean, they've said that they will do everything possible to make sure that Radio Free Europe can keep operating, which I guess is not the same as saying, like, we've got this, guys, everything's fine, but it's pretty close. By the way, I've been saying Radio Free Europe. I should really be talking about Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, because the media organization that I'm talking about is actually made up of two radio stations that got fused together in the 1970s. Both of them were set up in the 1950s by the CIA, in fact.
Really?
Turns out those guys do some good things sometimes. But yeah, both of these radio stations were originally run out of Munich in Germany. Radio Liberty beamed its programs to inside the Soviet Union, not just in Russian, but also in a bunch of other languages spoken within the bloc. And Radio Free Europe was initially set up to broadcast to some other non-USSR communist countries, including Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Poland. And these radio stations were very much part of the Cold War war of ideas back in the 50s. They were set up as an attempt to get Western ideas about freedom behind the Iron Curtain. But it wasn't just about propaganda. You know, this was, from the beginning, about getting accurate information to people in countries with authoritarian governments that keep a really tight grip on information. So during the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, for instance, in 1986, for 2 days afterwards, the official state media in Eastern Bloc countries didn't report anything about it.
Wow.
And they didn't really come clean and acknowledge that there'd been a disaster for months. And during that time, millions of people started tuning into Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty because they were broadcasting hours and hours of crucial, often life-saving coverage about what was happening. But then it was just like, you know, silence and then contradictory reports coming out of the USSR.
Okay, so it's clear that these radio stations did incredibly important work during the Cold War. Presumably, they've had to reinvent themselves since then.
Well, yes and no. I mean, so yes, in the cases of some languages, they did eventually stop broadcasting because these formerly communist countries became, you know, solid democracies with strong media systems where you could criticize the government and information could get out when it needed to. So by the mid-noughties, they'd stopped broadcasting in like Estonian and Latvian, for example, and also in Czech, the language of the country that now hosts Radio Free Europe. But the basic idea of this radio station, which was to get information about what's really happening to people who don't have access to free information, that unfortunately is not a mission that went away in the world with the fall of communism. There are still many, many governments that don't want their citizens to have free access to the news, and they certainly don't want their citizens to hear about it when they screw up. So today, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty estimates that it still reaches more than 47 million people every week. It broadcasts in Persian to Iran and to Afghanistan in Dari and Pashto, in Turkmenistan, which is one of the, you know, the most closed authoritarian countries in the world. This is the only independent radio station able to report inside the country in the Turkmen language. And similarly to the Chernobyl thing, during COVID, the Turkmen government banned the word COVID-19. And for a while, this radio station was really the only media outlet where people could get trustworthy information about what was happening in their own language. Mohammed Tahir, who used to direct the Turkmen service, he wrote a really moving essay about why its work is so important. And he wrote about all of the things that got fixed, not just in Turkmenistan, but in lots of countries, because of the work of these radio journalists. Things like schools getting repaired, electricity getting fixed, health crises averted, all because these radio stations expose government failures. Interestingly, some languages that they had stopped broadcasting in because it felt like, you know, these are well-functioning democracies now, they don't really need us, they've actually brought back those languages because over the years, the media in those places has sadly stopped working freely and become, to one extent or another, a government mouthpiece. So around 2019, 2020, they actually brought back their services in Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary, which says quite a lot about the state of media freedom in some countries that are within the European Union.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there is all of the broadcasting that Radio Liberty still does to serve people in Russia. And that has become more and more important in recent years as the full chilling extent of Putin's disinterest in democracy has become apparent. For information on the war in Ukraine, of course, these journalists are doing incredibly important work documenting Russian war crimes and generally reporting on what's happening on the ground in the Russian language. And you can tell it's important work because the Russian government does everything they can to stop them. More than 40 journalists from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, have been named by the Russian government as foreign agents. They now have to operate the Russian service out of Latvia because it's obviously not safe for them to be based in Russia itself. Numerous Radio Liberty journalists have indeed been jailed for their work within Russia and other countries. And these days, you know, obviously a lot of Russians aren't accessing this content via like actual radios, of course. In a lot of cases, it's via YouTube with a VPN. And for Ukrainians as well as Russians, you know, Radio Liberty continues to be a really trusted news source and an incredibly important one. Their team has done some incredibly important investigative journalism, even before the war, investigating corrupt oligarchs and also allegations around politicians, including, yes, the current president, Volodymyr Zelensky. And in places like Crimea, occupied parts of Ukraine, it is particularly important for Ukrainians to have this free, trustworthy source of information.
It seems like such a short-sighted decision by the US to cut this funding. I mean, as with so much of their aid funding, as soon as they step out of all these areas, like, it just leaves a gap open for more autocratic people to do more bad things. Yeah. I mean, that's really simple terms. And maybe the people in the White House associate more with those autocratic leaders than they do with people who believe in journalism, sadly. But despite that, I have to say, I've been surprised when talking about this with some of my friends and family over the last few weeks that quite a lot of people I know, like in the UK and in the Netherlands, had never heard of Radio Free Europe. But I guess that's because it's not broadcasting here.
Yeah, I don't think it's that surprising. I mean, we're lucky to be in countries that don't currently need this service, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, for millions of people who are in countries that are less free, this is incredibly important. And you're right that it's short-sighted. It's like all of the cuts with USAID. This is incredibly important work that has been funded by the US for years. It makes us all safer and better off as a planet. But because it seems like a bit obscure to Elon Musk and his buddies at Doge and a little bit too far away, they've decided, just cut it. It'll be fine. It's worth mentioning, actually, in terms of the media operations that get funded by the US or have done until now, it isn't just Radio Free Europe that is being cut off. The radio station shares a parent company with Voice of America, another absolutely massive international broadcaster that broadcasts in many, many languages. Radio Marti, which broadcasts to Cuba, and Radio Free Asia as well, which notably serves free information in languages like Chinese, Vietnamese, Uyghur. Musk has described these media outlets as, quote, radical left crazy people talking to themselves. Mm. But nothing could be further from the truth. And it's ironic, really, that these radio stations do so much to promote what is supposedly the value closest to Donald Trump's heart, which is freedom of speech. And then they're dismissed as a waste of US taxpayer money. And it's not even that much money. You know, Radio Free Europe has been getting about $142 million a year from the US government up until now, which I would argue for a government as rich as the US is not that much, especially when you think about the huge amount of soft power that the US has won by funding this service and essentially convincing tens of millions of people around the world that America are the good guys. And you only need to look at the reaction from Russian state media to this decision to know what this means. On the day when it was announced that Radio Free Europe was losing its funding, Margarita Simonyan, the editor-in-chief of the Russian state broadcaster RT, she told the Moscow Times, "Today is a holiday for me and my colleagues at RT and Sputnik. This is an awesome decision by Trump." I mean, knowing Trump, he'll probably just see this as praise. And he likes praise. And as we know, you know, he is certainly much more comfortable with the idea of being friendly with Russia than his predecessors were. But still, if Russian state media is congratulating you, you should probably ask yourself a few questions. We're definitely not at the end of the road in terms of the radio station losing its US funding. Radio Free Europe are in fact suing the US government, arguing that it has this budget because the US Congress gave it this budget. So legally, it has to spend the money. A similar legal argument was used by staff at USAID to try to challenge Trump's shutdown of all of their operations. And that ruling went in their favor. A judge ruled that the Trump administration has probably violated the Constitution in shutting them down. But Trump has vowed to appeal that ruling. So in both that case and the Radio Free Europe case, we'll have to wait and see what happens.
But even if they do lose the money, you've said that the Czech government are going to step in. This is good week, right?
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, $142 million is a lot more money for a small European government than for the US government. Like, are they going to definitely be able to do this?
I mean, it's looking promising. So Radio Free Europe has been based in Prague since 1995. So this is also a soft power thing for the Czech Republic, right? It is a point of pride to host this beacon of freedom that was once needed in this actual country that was behind the Iron Curtain. Petr Fiala, the Czech Prime Minister, he has talked about what this means to him personally. You know, he listens to Radio Free Europe under communism. And in any case, the Czechs wouldn't be doing this alone. They are talking to the EU about whether they might be able to get some cash from Brussels. And the EU does spend quite a lot of money on media freedom. They notably fund the radio network that we are a part of, Euronet Plus. They've also poured 100 million euros into supporting independent media in Ukraine. And in fact, they just announced another 10 million euros towards that this week. On the other hand, this is a really expensive time for the European Union. More on that in this week's interview segment. So it looks like this might need to be another coalition of the willing type thing, much in the way that things are headed with defense spending in Europe, in fact. And at the moment, there are about a dozen countries who the Czechs are talking to who've said that they should be able to chip in. So this is very much to be continued. But in a way, it kind of makes sense, right? I mean, like, much as we can't really expect the US to keep paying for us to defend ourselves from Russia in a situation where the US, frankly, isn't that interested in protecting us from Russia, if the US stops being a beacon of free speech, whatever Trump claims to believe in, Europe is going to be one of the remaining places in the world that cares the most about genuine freedom of speech. So even if we have less money than the US, maybe we need to put a bit of that money where our mouths is and actually spend it on supporting those values in the world.
Yeah, I mean, you could see spending on Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty as like defense money in a way, because it's like defending our values.
Defense is a very flexible idea.
Right? Well, I also think it's good to think of it more broadly than just like buying weapons.
I agree. Let's move on to bad week. Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
It's been a bad week for the world's leading AI chatbot, ChatGPT. A Norwegian man called Arve Hjalmar Holem has filed a complaint with the Norwegian Data Protection Authority against OpenAI, the US company behind ChatGPT, because when he asked ChatGPT the question, "Who is Arve Hjalmar Holmen?" it answered by saying that Arve had murdered two of his sons and that he'd been in prison for 21 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, I'll come to that in a bit. But I should first clarify, this is not true. Arve has never murdered anyone. He's never been accused of murdering anyone. He's just your regular non-murdering dad.
Jesus.
Arve reported OpenAI to the Norwegian data protection authorities because he believes the statement to be defamatory and damaging to him. And he thinks ChatGPT should be fined for breaking, according to him, Europe's data protection laws.
I would say that that counts as defamation. Yeah, falsely claiming that somebody murdered their kids, definitely. I mean, is it possible that ChatGPT was talking about a different person with exactly the same name? Like, maybe there is another guy who is called this who did commit this terrible crime.
Yeah, that could have been the case, but it's not the case. And the thing that's so shocking about this answer is that it was kind of mixed up with facts that are true about Arve's life. Like, it got correct the hometown he lives in, and the number of kids he has, their gender, and the age gaps between his children. It just made up the bit about him murdering his two sons.
Okay, so this whole thing is very, very disturbing. I mean, on the other hand, it is kind of known that AI chatbots are not to be fully trusted. No? I mean, like, ChatGPT has famously had problems with getting stuff wrong.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I hope people are aware of that, that ChatGPT gets a lot of things wrong. I do think a lot of people just believe what they are told on one of these AI chatbots. But in OpenAI's defense, there is a disclaimer at the bottom of the page when you ask ChatGPT anything that says, ChatGPT can make mistakes. Check important info. But yeah, there are simple factual inaccuracies, and then there is making up that you murdered your children and that their bodies were found in a pond near your home.
Oh wow. It's imagine some quite gruesome details there. Yeah. I mean, do we know how it came up with the story? Like, do we know what is happening inside that AI black box? Why would ChatGPT fabricate something like that?
Well, the made-up facts in this answer are what is referred to in the AI world as hallucinations. Hallucinations happen because the chatbot functions by predicting what the next word in a sentence is most likely to be. So it's a predictive approach that can, of course, lead to factual errors. And OpenAI say they are trying to work out how to reduce the number of hallucinations all the time. They also point out that this answer that Arve received was using an old model of ChatGPT. And that this kind of factual error, they claim, wouldn't happen with the updated model, which is enhanced with online search capacities that, quote, improve accuracy. I wanted to double check, so I tried searching the question, who is Arve Hjalmar Holmen, in the current version of ChatGPT. I should flag up, it's the free version. I don't pay for the enhanced model. And indeed, it came up with a more accurate answer that begins, Arve Hjalmar Holmen is a Norwegian citizen residing in Trondheim. He leads a private life, is not a public figure, and has never been accused or convicted of any crime.
Does it actually say that?
Yes.
Thank you for clarifying, robots.
I also, just because I was curious, decided to search you and me, Katie, on ChatGPT. Yeah. And in our cases, it was actually alarmingly accurate, which I guess is good news, but I also found it a bit freaky how much it knows about us. Like, it was talking about our different heritage and, like, yeah, I found that a bit weird.
Interesting. Guess that's what happens when you put a podcast on the internet and talk about yourself for 7 years.
Exactly, yeah. But honestly, I only had to ask ChatGPT a few follow-up questions about Arve's data protection claim. And I quickly came across things that the model was just making up. So, for example, I asked if anyone had written any interesting opinion pieces about Arve's defamation claim against ChatGPT in Norway. And it listed and summarized three articles discussing instances where ChatGPT has generated defamatory content. I thought, great. And I asked Chat to give me the links to the three articles it had summarized. And then it said, I apologize for the earlier confusion. Upon further research, I found that the previously mentioned articles do not exist.
Oh my God. So even when talking about its own lies, it makes stuff up. Get it together.
I know, I couldn't believe it. People, be careful when using ChatGPT or any other AI chatbots. They are indeed inclined to make things up. Do you ever use it, Katie?
I actually don't really at all. I mean, I guess I'm just a bit too old school as a journalist to go anywhere near it for anything to do with my work. But people in my life are increasingly using it for various stuff. And it has like genuinely useful applications. So my sister-in-law, for example, was trying to organize a lunch for a bunch of people with different like allergies and dietary requirements. And it was really complicated. And she asked ChatGPT to come up with a menu, and it actually had really good ideas.
That sounds like a great use of it, and kind of risky when it comes to putting the allergy requirements in and knowing that ChatGPT can make mistakes.
That is true. Nobody died though, so all good.
Okay, good. Pleased to hear that. Anyway, going back to Arva's complaint against ChatGPT, his referral to the Norwegian data protection authorities is being led by an Austrian data privacy group called NOIB. NOIB are making the complaint because, of course, being accused of murder can, quote, seriously damage a person's reputation. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, it really could. ChatGPT is used by so many people these days as essentially a search engine. And yeah, if it's saying you've murdered someone or committed some other awful crime, some people could believe it. And NOIB is saying that this is not an isolated case. They flag up a few other cases of alleged defamation against chatbots, including there was this famous case of an Australian mayor who was falsely labeled as being part of a bribery and corruption scandal by OpenAI. And there was also a German journalist who was accused of being a child molester by Microsoft's AI chatbot.
Oh my God. Jesus Christ. Awful.
So NOIB claim that OpenAI are knowingly allowing ChatGPT to produce defamatory results and therefore are violating the GDPR's principle of data accuracy.
Ah, GDPR, everyone's favourite European data protection law.
Yes, the GDPR. I actually feel like it is lots of people's favorite data protection law. But I mean,
don't know many others.
No, but it is claimed to be the strongest data protection legislation in the entire world. And I think a lot of people come across it when going on a website while they're in Europe and having to accept the cookies. And some people find that annoying. But it does have some really great things about it that help protect us as citizens. Mm-hmm. Joachim Söderberg is a data protection lawyer at NOIB. And he said the following. The GDPR is clear. Personal data has to be accurate. And if it's not, users have the right to have it changed to reflect the truth. Showing ChatGPT users a tiny disclaimer that the chatbot can make mistakes clearly isn't enough. You can't just spread false information and then, in the end, add a small disclaimer saying that everything you said may just not be true.
Yeah. I mean, so what are NOIB and Arva hoping that the Norwegian data protection authorities are actually going to do in response to this complaint?
Well, they hope that OpenAI will be forced to delete the quote-unquote defamatory content about Arva. I don't know why I said quote-unquote. I mean, it is pretty clearly defamatory. And they're hoping that even though the misinformation doesn't appear anymore, but still there is no way to know if the fake data about Arva is still being used in the data set of ChatGPT, because by default, ChatGPT feeds its user data back into the system for training purposes. And the lawyer just referred to it, but there's this right to rectification of personal data, which is a key part of the GDPR law. So that's the right to request a correction of inaccurate data that a company holds about a person. Mm-hmm. There's currently no system in place whereby individuals can request the incorrect data about them on ChatGPT is corrected. That seems like something that will surely have to change if chatbots like ChatGPT want to continue functioning in the European market. NOIB also urge OpenAI to further fine-tune their model, which, to be fair to OpenAI, they do seem to be doing anyway. And they also think OpenAI should be presented with an administrative fine as a disincentive to allowing the program to make similar mistakes in the future.
How much can a company actually be fined under the GDPR rules?
A lot of money. Ooh. Under the most serious set of infringements, the authorities can fine a company 20 million euros Ooh. Or 4% of the firm's worldwide annual revenue from the preceding financial year, whichever amount is higher.
Oh.
OpenAI were actually already fined 15 million euros by Italy's data protection watchdog at the end of last year for violations in collecting users' personal data. I believe that OpenAI are currently appealing that one. And look, it's been a bad week for ChatGPT. This complaint does not show the chatbot in a good light, and it could lead to a reprimanding from the data protection authorities once again. But it's important to note that there is a lot of uncertainty about how the authorities will deal with a case like this one from Arva. The ubiquity of generative AI is still pretty new in Europe, and Europe's privacy regulatory bodies are still working out quite how to apply the GDPR to generative AI. I will stop talking about it now, but if you really want to get into the legal nitty-gritty of this topic, then I'll share a link in the show notes to a very detailed article about generative AI lawfulness in the EU context from TechCrunch.
Sounds like a thrilling read. It genuinely does, because yeah. As discussed, we're nerds. So I will read that with pleasure.
Okay, enjoy. It's that time in the show where we ask you for some help. And we have two options for you. One, you could help us out financially by becoming a monthly supporter on patreon.com. There are various benefits to becoming a Patreon. You could get a postcard from us or a personalized voicemail message from Katie and me. And you can get access to our online community where we chat with you about all things going on in Europe. It's actually very nice now that we have this community chat set up on Patreon.
It's lovely, yeah. And it means we don't have to be on Facebook anymore where we used to be.
Which is great.
Boo Facebook.
The other option for helping us is to tell your friends about us. And now I wish there was a way to give shout outs or thanks to all these people who do an amazingly good job at telling their friends about us each week. Maybe we could just do it. Maybe, how about this? For anyone that posts about us in a story on Instagram or on Blue Sky and tags us, we'll give you a shout out next week. Should we see if that works?
Oh, I like that idea. Let's do it.
Thanks in advance to you all for your help. And thanks to our latest Patreon supporters. They are John, Sarah, and Oana.
Thanks so much, everyone. Time for this week's interview. And there has been one big, big story sloshing around in Europe for the past few weeks, which is defense, military stuff, guns and bombs and soldiers. Whatever you want to call it, it is a story about the fact that the US government has signaled that it is no longer prepared to keep making the significant contribution that it has made historically since World War II towards defending Europe against Russia and other threats that might appear on the horizon. Which means that Europe is suddenly faced with huge political decisions over what we're going to do about this. And the upshot is that there's been a massive change in the way that European politicians have been talking about defense in recent weeks, and apparently a pretty significant motivation to actually do more than just talk. There is a plan, an EU plan, to spend an astonishing 800 billion euros on our collective defense over the next 4 years. We have a lot of questions about how this would supposedly work, and we found a really great person to ask them to, who we'll introduce in a second. But joining me for this week's interview is our producer, Wojciech, in Warsaw. Hi, Wojciech.
Hello, hi.
So apparently people have been talking about this quite a lot in Poland, huh?
Yeah, that's true. I have to say, you know, since 1990s, when I was able to talk to people, I have never actually talked with anyone about security or, you know, my preparedness for a possible, you know, military confrontation. And now every time I see my friends, like every time we gather in a bigger group, at some point during the meeting, this would come up, you know, a question of like, what do we do? Like, what do we do if there's a conflict? Who's thinking of buying, you know, a house on an island very far away from here? Wow. So yeah, it is a sort of, you know, a talk of the town recently.
I mean, I woke up in the morning and was scrolling the news on my phone, and I saw this headline about how Poland was going to ask all men to do some kind of military training. And I just thought, like, Jesus, I wonder how Wojciech's feeling this morning.
No, you got it a bit wrong. It was Donald Tusk does Donald Tusk thing. So he came, you know, on the parliamentary podium one day and said that they're gonna train 100,000 people to become what he called very finally fully serviceable soldiers in a matter of a few days. This is not true, but actually what has transpired now after this has become a bit less vague is that actually this is a pretty good plan to increase Poland's preparedness for a military conflict. So what we know now is that there's going to be like a lot of different ways to get trained. There are like one-day trainings, three-day trainings, a month-long training. This is all voluntary. You can subscribe to that and you'll be paid for the longer, you know, versions of that. It's first of all building like civilians' preparedness for war, and then maybe trying to attract some people to military service, because after you've done this, you can follow this up with some more specialized training that would actually make you a serviceable soldier on the battleground. Because let's be honest, after 3 days of training, you're nothing else than a cannon fodder.
Poland actually has like the biggest army in the EU already, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the numbers look pretty good. But then, you know, from the Ukrainian experience, we know that any professional army is not big enough in times of such a war. But then what I think we're lagging behind really strongly is the civilians' preparedness for war. We have a pitiful, you know, like some sort of classes in high school, and that's that. No one knows where are the shelters. As far as I know, there are not that many shelters. And like, I really think this is something that we could work on. And actually, you know, it's funny because like every time, usually when a politician says something bold, there's a lot of criticism around that. And I have not really seen anyone criticizing this, except for criticizing the vagueness. But I think the message was loud and clear, and everybody's sort of on the same page. We need to get more prepared, just like, you know, our friends in Finland, Sweden. You know, there are a lot of footprints for how to really become a more prepared society.
Yeah, here in the Netherlands, there's like a lot of clear government advice on like how much extra tinned food and bottled water you need to have, and radios that are battery charged, and torches and candles. So that's the kind of preparedness we have, but like we hardly have any army at all here. So
yeah,
we'd also be pretty screwed.
I think our sense of preparedness varies from country to country. I mean, we haven't had anything like that kind of information dropping through our letterboxes here in France. But I mean, you know, even though this does vary by geography, this is definitely something that is on people's minds and politicians' minds, especially across the continent. And it is something that is starting to take a more concrete form. So last week, the EU released this document, a white paper, setting out plans for a new long-term defense strategy in detail. And it is essentially about preparing for worst-case scenarios. Specifically, we might imagine further Russian invasions in Europe in a situation where we can't rely on the might of the US military to help us out. Broadly, it's about becoming less dependent on the US for help in general and being able to defend Europe on our own. So it includes more support for Ukraine, a closer integration of the US defense industry with Ukraine's defense industry, and a massive, massive increase in spending. How would this whole thing work? What does it mean? Defense as an idea can seem pretty abstract, so we thought we would bring in someone who could untangle all of this for us. Marina Henker is a professor of international relations at the Hertie School in Berlin. She researches European security and defense policy, and since she teaches this stuff too, we thought she'd be the perfect person to give us a defense primer this week. This conversation is brought to you in collaboration with radio stations across Europe as part of our partnership with Euronet Plus. And once again, we have decided to put a longer version of this conversation out on our YouTube channel with lots and lots of extra detail. So the real defense nerds should head there. You will find a link in the show notes. But if you're sticking with the audio version, here's Marina. Marina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me to this amazing show. I feel like a very strong European. So when I saw the title of your podcast, I was like, I will participate. I will join.
You were meant to join us. I guess my first question is, there is this plan to spend a hell of a lot more money on defense in Europe in the years to come. Before we get to the tricky question of where that money is supposed to come from, what is it exactly that we're planning to spend this money on?
So as you probably know, Europe is pretty weak when it comes to its defense capabilities. That's just a fact. Some folks called it free riding. Others said Europe was focusing on civilian and normative power. But when it comes to military capabilities and also the readiness of European forces, Europe is weak. And now with the election of President Trump, I think there was a decision that we need to change that. And I think it will kind of go into two big chunks of programs. The first one is to acquire military capabilities, especially the capabilities that we do not have and where we rely on US equipment so far. And the other thing I think is also to build up our forces. So this is personnel and this is training.
There seems to have been a lot of back and forth already in discussions around building up defense in Europe. So one day we hear about plans to spend 800 billion, and the next we learn that Italy and France are opposing a 5 billion injection to buy ammunition for Ukraine. So my question is, when it comes to the core priorities of European defense, are all countries in the grand scheme of things moving in the same direction, or is it just another case of a European ship with no captain?
I'm sitting in Berlin when I'm talking to you. I think Germany's role here is absolutely critical. I think a lot of the previous attempts to build up European defense didn't succeed because Germany wasn't on board. And I think this is really different this time. The incoming Merz administration seems absolutely determined. Two packages passed last week here, both of our houses, the Bundestag and the Bundesrat. And defense is front and center. And I really think that Germany is serious at this time. And so if Germany, as still the largest European Union member state, is serious about defense, I think something will happen. Of course, there will always be some countries that don't join. And in the big picture of things, it's okay. I think they should have the liberty and freedom not to join every program. But if there is, you know, like a sufficient large amount of countries that is serious this time, and I think Eastern Europe is serious, Scandinavia is serious, I think Germany is serious, also Great Britain, and I'm very happy that they're back. I think they're also very much on board. And I think also the French, in the larger picture of things, they are on board with these initiatives. The Dutch are, I think the Belgians are. Then you have maybe Hungary, maybe a Slovakia right now under Fico, much more hesitant. Meloni, we can discuss, you know, like where Italy stands, but I think she has also an interest in bolstering Italian defense industries. So in the big picture of things, I think this is a game changer, and I think we will see something happening.
Maybe let me follow up with a question about Germany that I was supposed to ask later, but you are speaking to us from Germany. It is the biggest economy in Europe, but also a country that has been really wary of having a strong military since World War II for obvious reasons. And after the full-scale invasion on Ukraine, Germany famously had a supposed turning point in its military policy. We are now seeing yet another major turning point in Germany's defense policies. And I would like to know, which one do you think is the most important?
Well, when it comes to the money, now, the recent Zeitenwende that we have seen enacted last week is certainly more important than anything that has ever happened in German defense history since the end of the Cold War. And of course, you can ask what has shifted, and it is the United States. It wasn't the invasion of Ukraine. I mean, that triggered something. I think Germans did wake up that Russia was a revisionist power and you couldn't trust them. But very quickly after the invasion, the Germans kind of, you know, I still like the term free riding. I think they thought the United States is fully on board and the Biden administration was fully on board. German military aid and also non-military aid grew because when the Republicans took over again in the House, so after the midterm elections in the United States, there were a lot of Republican delegations coming to Berlin and saying, you need to step up. So we very much saw also U.S. pressure. And with the inauguration of Trump and just in general, his relationship with Putin, how he treated Zelensky in the White House, all of this kind of accumulated in what we see today. Of course, I think there's always like also a flip side that is important for everybody to know. And this is the economic situation in Germany. So I think if the German economy was booming, we maybe wouldn't have seen such a massive investment package. But there is, of course, also like the idea that this massive investment package in defense, coupled, of course, also with infrastructure and now 100 million in climate, will boost German productivity. You will have spillover effects. You will have, you know, production lines that Volkswagen and Audi no longer use, that they can be taken over by Rheinmetall and other defense industries. So, you know, like, I mean, I think the backstory is one of first Russian aggression, then the shaky situation of the transatlantic alliance. But then also there is an interest in combining defense spending with a revival of the German economic base.
So that is the idea, that we would spend loads of money, but more money kind of gets generated out of it. At the same time, it's an astonishing amount of money, 800 billion euros. Where is that money supposed to come from? And how realistic is this plan to raise that money?
In Germany, in very particular, and the EU is a little bit of a different story, but Germany has a fairly low debt to GDP ratio. So the UK, I think it's about 105%. In France, it's over 100%. Germany, it was 60%. So yes, in the Western European world, Germany can increase its debt level. And this is what happens here. So like Germany now goes from about 60% to 80%. It is still the third largest economy in the world. Germany can stomach this. On the EU level, I mean, you know, on the one hand, it is small loans that come at a low interest rate. I think that's like 150 million. And the other one, the 600 billion, this is that you kind of loosen borrowing limits that were part of the growth and stability pact of the euro. So in the big picture of things, you kind of like allow members of the eurozone to take on more debt. Also, of course, building on the credibility and viability of the euro as a currency. If you listen to some critics, they basically say in the long run, it will undermine the credibility of the euro as a currency. Others would say, you know, whether you look at the Draghi report, this is exactly the stimulus that is needed. Now it comes in a very different shape and form. Like Draghi never really mentioned a massive defense stimulus, but in the end, it is a type of stimulus that he also asked for.
Mm. There's been a lot of focus on reaching higher percentages of GDP on defense spending. Is that definitely the best way of making us actually safer, just focusing on how much money gets spent? And also, you know, this idea of spending more as a percentage of our budgets than we were previously spending on defense, as opposed to, you know, the other places that money is going to have to come from, which is the health budget, the education budget, welfare support, everything else. There's not necessarily any incentive to spend the money more efficiently or effectively, is there? Like, is there a risk that all of this extra spending will just beef up the industry, yes, and maybe create a lot of profit for a few individuals and companies, but not necessarily make us that much safer at the same time?
Yeah, so in Germany, it's one of the exceptional cases, but since I think it is such a critical player in this question, the idea right now is that you don't necessarily have major cuts in other areas. That's why you have these massive spending packages. I think in other countries, it will not be that way. But you're 100% right that just talking about money is not useful. So I teach strategy. In my classes, the first thing that you always determine is what's actually your objective? What do you want actually to achieve? And then you look at where do you get the resources from? Europe is still, and in Germany certainly, like it's still in the unclear, right? It's not entirely certain what we actually want to achieve. Do you want to protect Ukraine from Russia? So will Ukraine then become a European Union member state? Or is it, you know, that we're just protecting European Union territories, or like we want to protect the Baltic states and the eastern flank? Is this is what we actually want to do? Or is it in the end, you know, like Germany is just building up its own defenses? So like they're drawing the line then, you know, like at the Polish border, like there are no clear answers. Right now, it's just there is money on the table. And of course, money is better than no money, but it's certainly not enough.
There's been a lot of talk over the past couple of weeks about the need for a coalition of the willing in Europe to lead this effort to boost our defense. And to what extent is that coalition already emerging, in your opinion? And who are the main countries who look, well, less interested in joining that coalition?
So there's still a lot of mystery, right? Who will join this coalition of the willing? Actually, apart from a firm British and French contribution, I haven't heard of any other contingents that have been confirmed. Of course, you know, there's always the trade-off. Should we protect our own country or should we go to Ukraine, right? This is very often the trade-off. And so I don't think that the Polish government is refusing to join out of, you know, like we're not interested in Ukraine. But any kind of contingent that goes to Ukraine cannot protect our own borders. And I think this is this concern.
And then at the same time, you have countries like Hungary who seem not so interested. Does it matter if not all EU countries want to be involved in this to the same extent or at all?
You know, in the big picture of things, no, because Hungary is fairly small. Of course, it can be a spoiler. We have to be very careful because, of course, when it gets to sensitive information, Hungary can also leak this information. I would much rather have a Hungary on board than outside of it. But if you really want to build up European security and defense, you need a critical amount of European Union member states. And whether Hungary participates in this or not is not absolutely critical for the success of this endeavor.
Also, some numbers caught my eye recently. Poland allocates almost 5% of its GDP to defense. Baltic countries spend between 3.5% to 6%. Portugal has made a heroic pledge to reach 2% by 2029. And Spain lags behind at just 1.3%, and they're having a really hard time increasing that number. You don't need to be a scholar to see the pattern. And I still believe that defense and defending ourselves against Russia is essentially a pan-European challenge. So do you think there's a chance that this burden could be distributed more evenly?
Look, in all big countries and federations in the United States, it is the country that I know the best. You have certain states that do more and others do less. Certain states are interested in certain topics and others are not so interested in certain topics. I think that just comes with geography, that comes with history. Portugal has, you know, like his own advantages and disadvantages. And I think in certain situations, if they don't block initiatives, I think it's okay if they don't necessarily engage to the same extent in these defense efforts as, for example, the frontline states, as the Baltic states and Poland.
I wanted to finish this conversation, Marina, by asking you about the human side of all of this and the potential human cost if, God forbid, there are further conflicts on this continent. This plan is not just about having more guns and bombs. It is about having more troops that could potentially defend us. And obviously, no country likes sending its people, in particular its younger people, to be killed in a war. Can you give us a sense of how different countries around Europe are thinking about this need for bodies? I mean, we have pretty different policies around the continent when it comes to conscription and military service, also things like civil preparedness and getting citizens aware of stuff like, you know, really basic things like where to get shelter. How are we preparing for this? How are governments thinking about this across the continent?
Yeah, very important question, because indeed, the approaches here have been very different. And my favorite approach so far has been the Scandinavian approach, because it basically tells its population, and, you know, probably you saw this very famous brochure now that they distributed last year, How to Prepare in Case of War, I think it's called. It explains in very plain language, an attack on our country is a possibility, but we can do things to stop it. We are prepared. And here is what you can do, how you can get prepared. You can actually draw strength from this preparation. And I think this is very smart. You know, I deal with young people all the time, especially in Germany until Russia's invasion of Ukraine. They were told war is an impossibility. But it always has been an illusion. Still, now the defense ministry here tries to recruit young people, at least this was under the Scholz government, with the slogan of, you know, join the military, it will be an adventure. I don't think that this is a good narrative, right? You shouldn't join the military to seek adventure. This is not about deploying to faraway places in Africa and the Middle East and contributing to peacekeeping operation. This is really protecting your continent. And so I think it is much more a civil duty. So I think the most useful approach and how I think, you know, like you can mobilize people is the Scandinavian approach to say, we have built an absolute beautiful community and we need to protect it because it is under attack. We need every single one of you to do your part. And some will do it in a security and defense and military way. Others will do it politically. Others will do it in the private sector or in media, you know, like wherever that is. But it is now a task that we have at hand. We have to rise to this occasion. And, you know, like everybody needs to participate.
Okay, Katie, so how do you feel about your nation's ability to take on even more debt?
Yeah, thank you for that reference to France's finances, which I am aware are in a pretty bad state right now. So yeah, I have to confess, the idea of like huge extra debts does ring alarm bells. I was actually surprised to find myself becoming like slightly less anxious on like a Europe-wide scale about the money side of things during that conversation. I mean, like long-term as a society, do we want to spend more money on the military as a percentage rather than stuff like health and reducing poverty and education? That's a different conversation.
I mean, possibly we are just not in a position to decide. Maybe it's just a necessity. It's, you know, our enemies that are deciding what are we spending money for, not us. I would also prefer to spend this money on education or rewilding or anything else. But yeah, that's the reality, I guess.
Absolutely.
Something that makes my head spin is like, where is this money coming from? Because I understand these are loans, but who are we really loaning from? It seems like a astronomical amount of money. And I really don't understand. To me, it sounds as if we're talking about Hogwarts, like just the level of absurdity of this amount of money is like, I don't really get it.
Don't think about it, Wojciech. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm trying not to think about it. So that was the idea for a segue to something more concrete, is that something that's being really discussed a lot in my region, so Central and Eastern Europe, is the bad influence of Hungary and Slovakia. And I've seen pretty, you know, serious columnists writing that maybe it's time to think about somehow booting out Hungary, at least from the decision-making process.
Mm.
And I have to say, you know, after all these experiences, it seems like it's time to be agile now, to be able to take decisions pretty quickly. And it seems like it's never going to be easy with those two in office. Obviously, they might change at some point, but I guess, I don't know, people have been suggesting some conditionality that you can be in the mix if you, you know, for example, don't have a lot of problems with rule of law in your country or something like that.
Yeah, well, sorry, Dominic here, I'm back.
Hi.
Great interview, you two.
Thanks.
Well, Tom Tones, at the beginning of this year on our podcast, this Dutch political scientist, he suggested on this show that the solution is to kind of create an alternative European Union without Hungary, because it's going to be too complicated to like kick them out of decision making. Mm. I wonder whether that actually could become a reality.
Yeah, maybe that's building an entire new European Union is a bit far-fetched, but I guess for specifically military and, you know, secret services operations, maybe there should be a closer group, that there will be more trust within this group between members, and also more of an active will to participate in all those efforts to build up European defense.
Katie's doing her heavy breathing. I think we should move on.
Look, this is a heavy breathing topic, okay?
Okay.
Thank you, Wojciech, for joining me this week.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Let's head to the Inspiration Station. What have you been enjoying this week, Dominic?
I finally got around to watching the Georgian film And Then We Danced.
Oh, love that film.
It's about 6 years old now. It's classic me coming to the party 6 years too late. But I'm sure I'm not the only member of this podcast community who hasn't seen it. So I thought it was still worth discussing. It's a film that follows a secret love that develops between two male dancers in the Georgian National Ensemble. And it's about their struggle to make it in the conservative world of Georgian dance whilst trying to keep their attraction for each other hidden. It's such a beautiful film.
Gorgeous film.
Yeah, I was fascinated by all the characters and immersed in this world of Georgian dance. Yeah, it's called And Then We Danced, and it's available to stream all over the place in the Netherlands. So I imagine it'll also be available wherever you are, somewhere. Obviously, Georgia has changed quite a lot in 6 years.
Mm.
The ruling Georgian Dream Party has moved the country towards Russia and away from EU. That is despite huge protests that erupted after the parliamentary elections last October, the results of which are considered illegitimate due to fraud by various international observers. There was also a sweeping piece of anti-LGBTQ plus legislation that passed in autumn last year. So life has got even harder for queer people in Georgia since this film was made. But that's even more reason to watch it, I think, a film that really shines a light on queer people in Georgia. So if, like me, you missed it when it came out, give it a watch. It's a wonderful picture.
And the dance scenes are also incredible. Like, I've never really seen traditional Georgian dance before watching that film, and it's just really breathtaking.
Yeah, they're great. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, I've got a podcast to recommend that I actually heard about through Wojciech. I can't travel very much this year for various reasons. So I'm enjoying audio that lets me travel, And he mentioned this podcast called The Bittersweet Life, which is about Italy. It is co-hosted by two childhood friends from Seattle who both found themselves living in Rome. One of them has since moved back to the US, but the other of whom has very much made her life in Italy. She married an Italian, is the mother of an Italian-speaking child. And it's a very nice, cozy listen. It actually has a kind of similar vibe to this podcast in that it is co-hosted by two friends who've known each other forever. And Katie and Tiffany cover a range of different topics from a foreigner's perspective in Italy, and unashamedly so. But they include a recent deep dive into the current Pope. There are also episodes on what ancient Romans did for fun and ancient Roman infrastructure that's been repurposed, but also things like bilingualism within families and the very thorny question of why some people get described as expats and others as immigrants.
Good question.
A very good question. So check it out if you are interested in questions like that. It is called The Bittersweet Life, and you can find it wherever you're listening to this.
I love listening to two friends chat about Europe. Time for a happy ending. And for my happy ending this week, I'm taking us to Bulgaria, where two Sundays ago, the top-tier Bulgarian team, Arda Kajali, was playing a match against Levski Sofia.
Sorry, and what sport is this?
Football, sorry.
I think you need to clarify, we're not all sportsters around here.
No, I know, I just assume you'd know. Anyway, before the match started, it was announced over the tannoy that the former Arda Kajali player, 78-year-old Petko Ganchev, had died. There was a minute's silence in memory of the wonderful player, and the match then began. But it was a mistake. Petko is alive.
Oh!
Somehow, the football team had been misinformed. The team posted an apology on their Facebook page, wishing Petko many more years of good health.
That's so awkward. How did that happen?
Yeah, I don't actually know how it happened. But what's funny is Petko, he spoke to the Bulgarian website Blitz about this saga. And apparently he usually watches all of the football matches from his former team on television. This time, he just happened to be running 10 minutes late. And whilst he was in the car, he got like this flurry of calls from people checking if he was dead, I guess. And he said to the journalist that being buried alive is quite stressful, actually. And he came home and his wife was in tears, apparently.
Oh, no.
Which is quite sad. But he also seems to have found the sense of humor in it. He said, "When I heard the terrible news, I poured myself a small brandy."
Good for you, Petko. You deserved a big one.
Someone's getting fired.
From military spending to undead footballers, we will be back next Thursday with more of this weird mixture of stuff from Europe. In the meantime, don't forget to email us if your local supermarket also seems to be killing plants en masse. We want to help Stephanie in Bavaria figure out if this is a Europe-wide problem or not, even though Dominic doesn't seem to think it's very important.
What? I just said it's not a problem in the Netherlands, I thought.
Well, keep an eye out for it, please, people.
Okay. thank you to our producers this week, Wojciech Oleksiak and Morgan Childs. If you miss us over the course of the week, go and check us out on Blue Sky, Instagram, Mastodon, or
YouTube.
YouTube, yes. And I've promised to give you a shout out if you mention us and tag us in a story.
Yay.
On Instagram or Blue Sky before we record next week. If you could do it before Tuesday, that would be ideal.
What if no one does it?
Then no one will get a shout out.
Okay, we'll just pretend it never happened.
Yes.
We'll see you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Ahoy.